Hello and welcome to Beyond the Mekong. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for The Diplomat. And with me today is Sean Turnell, who many listeners will know as the famed economist who worked with Aung San Suu Kyi under her civilian government and then spent a year and a half or more in prison after that government, the elected government, was ousted in November 2020. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Luke. It's a real pleasure to be on the program.
It's been a long journey for you. You came out and you wrote, I don't know if it was your first book, but certainly your experiences in prison must have been one hell of a time, and it certainly made for a good read. And now you've got another book out, Best Laid Plans, which is about the economic revival of Myanmar under Suu Kyi, which came to an unfortunate end with the coup. Can you take us back through those days about the hopes and the aspirations of some kind of economic reform, revival, and what the plans were for Myanmar in those days?
Yeah, sure, Luke. So the whole reason I was in Myanmar was because of that, basically to help them with a very strong economic reform program, all of which had been developed locally, but I was helping out my Burmese colleagues to try and push forward. It was, you know, very well thought out. Some young Burmese economists, full of energy, full of knowledge and all the rest of it. And we were really pushing it. Essentially from 2016, when the NLD government came in, building on some foundations that had been laid before, because Myanmar had begun to transform a little while earlier as well. But a very vigorous campaign to try and let the country catch up to some of the other tiger economies. Of course, a story that Myanmar had missed out on.
Right. And there were some familiar stories in your narrative which resonated with me in particular in regards to other countries like Cambodia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and these countries that never seemed to be able to get off the bottom, and finally there was some hope for Myanmar and where it was going.
Absolutely, mate. All of which made the coup and all that's followed just so frustrating, because we really got to that place where I was convinced and all of my colleagues were convinced that the economy was ready to go, you know, and that Myanmar at last could become the country it, you know, it always should have been.
You were dealing with the Chinese back then as well. What was that like?
Very, very difficult, Luke. Myanmar was one of the targets for the Belt and Road Initiative of the Chinese. So we found ourselves in constant negotiation with China over some of those really enormous infrastructure projects. And I guess, mate, the biggest problem, well, we had a couple of problems, actually. First, the infrastructure programs themselves often paid scant attention to their social impact and their environmental impact and all that. But with my economist hat on, I had to worry a lot about the debt. Because basically Myanmar was being asked to pay for these programs, many, many billions of dollars of debt, all to be taken on at commercial interest rates. So, part of what I was doing there actually was to push against some of this and go to the Chinese and say, look, some of these projects are valid, some of them are not, but even the ones that are okay, we need to renegotiate the debt terms. So spent a lot of time doing that. And we actually had some success. It was really interesting. Myanmar, in a sense, proved that you could say no to China every now and then.
Right. And, I mean, does that include the oil and gas pipeline that runs across the country, particularly through Rakhine State up through Lashio, which fell to the anti-regime forces about 3 weeks ago, I think. But how much involvement did you have with that oil and gas pipeline, which I think is going to be one of the more controversial projects going forward?
Yeah, it sure is, mate. A very controversial project. I didn't have much to do with that. It had been approved already by the government before Aung San Suu Kyi. So it had sort of been pretty much constructed by the time she came into power. But some of the associated infrastructure around that was still to come. So a big port facility at Jiaopu, for instance, where the pipelines ended. So there was a lot of investment around it. But, the pipeline itself had actually already been agreed, even though, you know, it had taken such a long time to come online. But and it finally did around that period that she got into power.
I think the pipeline's interesting currently because given the success of the Arakan army in Rakhine State, and we keep hearing stories that they're not in the mood to negotiate, that what they really want to do is set up their own state. And that runs all the way up through into Lashio. And this could be an enormous point of friction over the next few years. If the regime was to fall, if there were moves to set up a new federated Myanmar and what it would look like, the Chinese, through that oil and gas pipeline, are going to want a very big say.
Absolutely, Luke. And I think this is the real dilemma for China, because, you know, that they had the okay for these projects under past military governments in Myanmar, plus they've got it under this new terrible SAC regime that's ruling now. But, of course, the big issue is who controls the actual territory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the moment, the military government is saying to China, yeah, look, you know, come in and all of that. But, of course, they can't guarantee any security over these projects at all. So there's a problem even now for China, but bigger problems down the line, as you say. If the regime was to finally crumble, which it's showing all signs of doing so, then I think the Chinese will be in a very difficult situation, and the whole negotiations could be really fraught, I would imagine.
Given your history of negotiations with them, how do you rate them at the moment? They get mixed reviews. There is a lot of prejudices out there about China, given the last 10 years of the way I think they've conducted themselves through Belt and Road. But they've been very hands-on, and they're one of the few countries that have actually dealt with many sides to the conflict as opposed to just dealing with the junta.
Yeah, indeed, mate. I dealt with the bad side of them in some ways, you know, because it was all about this debt that was, mm-hmm. you know, truly bad for Myanmar. On the other hand, of course, they certainly get infrastructure done. One can certainly say that. I think the problem that I would have with China's overall policy is that they would always be looking out for entities and individuals who would do their bidding, if you like.
Right.
And that's sort of understandable, you know, from a national interest point of view, from their national interest. But, yeah, but I guess from the Myanmar point of view, you know, you're always trying to push back on that and to look out for Myanmar's interests rather than China's.
Right. Just quickly, how much was the debt? Remind me.
Well, the debt was about $11 billion mm-hmm. on the Jiaopu project alone. And in the renegotiations, Myanmar's key reformers were able to pull that down to just over $1 billion. So get it down by 90%, and most importantly, remove any sovereign guarantees. So in the end, the Chinese firms that would have been in charge of the development of the port, they would have ended up holding the bag had it all gone badly, which
right.
every indication was that it would have. So really important set of negotiations that essentially just took the burden away from Myanmar.
Right. So what I'm trying to get at is, where would China stand over the next, well, let's say 6 months to a year, in that my sources in Myanmar have been saying that the anti-regime forces would like to take Mandalay by the end of this year, which it's conceivable. And that would certainly have to be a game changer in terms of the perceptions, the realities confronting the regime, that he who holds Mandalay must certainly, apart from Naypyidaw and Yangon, they control the country. And it's kind of like where I'm trying to steer the conversation is that, where do you see China fitting in over the next 6 months to a year? Do you think that General Min Aung Hlaing, can he hang on? And well, where will this leave the NUG, should they have a say in what happens next?
Yeah, so I think Min Aung Hlaing won't be able to hang on, Luke. I think there'll be many atrocities and terrible things as he goes out the door, but I do think his days are numbered. I think his days are numbered from his own side. I think, you know, there are many people, even within his own regime, that would like to see the end of him. I think likewise the Chinese, just to bring them back into the story. As we know, China wants a stable Myanmar. It's not interested in a vibrant democracy next door or anything like that, but it is interested in a stable country that can be a source of raw materials, can be a market and all that. So I think the Chinese are playing a role already. I think a very strong role in some of the fighting that's been going on against the regime. I think there's been nods and winks at various points in that process from China. So I think they're one of the forces that would like to see the end of Min Aung Hlaing. Now, what emerges from that, you know, who knows? I think it would just depend upon the degree of the collapse of the regime more broadly, which also seems to be on the cards. You know, it doesn't seem just to be the end of Min Aung Hlaing. It does seem to be the end of the regime itself. You know, is what is ahead of us, which brings the NUG, exactly as you said, mate, into focus. I think, mate, that their role would be very similar to the NLD's, which was extraordinarily pragmatic when it came to China. In fact, in the little book you mentioned that was just coming out, I've got a quote in there from Suu Kyi. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it basically says, look, I'm not pro anything except pro Myanmar. And that came from a question put to her about China and about whether she was too close to China. And she was saying, look, I'm not too close to China. I'm not too close to America. It's just Myanmar I'm looking out for. So I would imagine, mate, that the NUG would be very similar.
Right. I remember that quote, and I certainly remember the days when Suu Kyi was, well, her star had fallen, and it was very easy to criticise her over pretty much anything, and China was one of those subjects. But in regards to the NUG, they have a stated position that they want to return to the status quo that came out of the elections in November 2020. Is that a realistic objective?
Well, I think it is, Luke. I think it's the only objective, to be honest, mate, in the sense that I don't think the current generation, you know, the young generation out on the streets that are fighting the military, you know, right across Myanmar, I don't think that they would be willing to accept a compromise that could leave the military largely in charge, or even in charge to the extent that they were when the NLD government was in power. You know, I think that model, if you like, of cohabitation with the military is just not acceptable anymore. So, yeah, so I do think some sort of result that is, you know, more or less identical to that that came out of the elections in November 2020 is what we'd be looking at. But I think, you know, what the NUG has in mind is that would be an interim period, and I know that they don't see themselves as a longer-term government, you know, that this is a process that would actually bring about new elections and new sort of political arrangement, which, as I say, with the very strong objective of just taking the military completely out of the equation.
Right. One of the reasons why I asked this question wasn't so much from the perspective of having to negotiate with the military. I quite understand. I agree that the people who are running that military should be in The Hague before an international court. But what I'm also wondering about are the ethnic armed organisations, PDF to a lesser extent. But it's kind of, they're going to have to strike a deal with the other ethnic groups as well. And then you've got Rakhine that's completely breaking apart. And one other quick point is that one of the criticisms I have heard of Aung San Suu Kyi's government was that during her 8 years in power was that she pretty much ignored the ethnic states in terms of the Karen, the Kachin, the Mon. Would that change? I mean, what does the NUG have to do to bring, from an economic perspective, to bring the other states on board?
Yeah, really interesting question, Luke. My observation, mate, is that this is the single area of biggest change between the NUG and, again, this younger generation and the old NLD government. Mm-hmm. I think, even though I don't think they meant to ignore, ethnic communities and so on, but I think that the practice of it sometimes did turn out that way, even if the intent was not there. So I think, for instance, mate, there was a view, and I, you know, include myself in this, where the view that if you reform society, you reform the economy, then you start to turn to issues about federalism and all that. And I think what there is now is a much better understanding that you've got to begin with stories like federalism. In other words, you've got to begin right from the outset. That this cannot come from the centre. And just in my discussions with people in the NUG, but also younger people more broadly, including in various ethnic communities, is that that is a really strong objective. This is not something they need to be convinced about or anything, but right from the get-go, a much greater sense of economic and social justice right across, and in practice, that probably leads us, to some sort of just federal fiscalism, basically, which essentially just means that the wealth society, etc., is divided up, much more evenly. You begin with taxation arrangements and government spending and all that, that redistributes according to need, and also, deals with things like resource revenues from different parts of the countries, etc. So, in other words, there's all sorts of technical institutions and policies that can underlie that sort of just federal outcome.
Right. Are you aware of any the individual ethnic states actually starting to go it alone currently, and in terms of negotiating the sale of their resources to outsiders, people outside the country?
I'm not personally. I've certainly read various things like that.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me, because in a sense, I guess my comments would sound very positive and all that, and I do feel very positive.
Sure.
But I don't want to sound naive about it either, if you know what I mean, because Myanmar's history is full of all sorts of terrible problems precisely on this front. So I would not be surprised for a minute if there were sort of variances from the sort of model that we want to see. I'm sure that there'll be differences in different regions and different sort of specific circumstances.
One would imagine that the contracts drawn up by the military since the coup would simply be torn up, and legally one would understand that. The ethnic groups going it alone would pose another issue, given that there's this great argument, are they fighting for Myanmar or are they fighting for their independence, depending on who you're talking to. So it is a little bit, there are a lot of legal landmines waiting to be stepped on going forward.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. And then even the practice, I think, of being a negotiating partner, because little states get picked off one by one usually, particularly when one is negotiating with, big countries like China and India and all the rest of it. So, the idea of sticking together has a certain logic to it, even just from that economic bargaining point of view. But having said that, I'm sure that there would be breakaways and so on along the way. So, it's I guess how to manage that and how to convince people broadly that again, some sort of just fiscal framework is what's on offer.
Let's assume that the military is defeated and that the NUG has a say as a recognised political party who, that they held government, they won it, and they were ousted illegally. What sort of makeup do you see Myanmar going forward? Do you think it's possible to restore the entire country as it was, or do you think there's going to have to be a lot of give and take in terms of how it shapes up?
Well, I think there'll have to be a lot of give and take, Luke, to be honest, and because again, I think there's just a much different feeling about how to start things, and again, as I say, to begin with that idea of negotiating with all the groups across the country, rather than assuming power, then beginning the negotiation. So I think that's the major difference. There'll be parts of that process and different events that don't work out, in a positive way that one would hope. But I guess getting across that idea that Myanmar can be constructed in a way that really does deliver the best, not just to the Burma majority, but to everyone in the society. That's the central aim, it seems to me, and it's what all the people that I speak to in the opposition movement, that they begin with that as a as an assumption, you know, that they don't need to be argued into it. That's where they're starting from.
Are you frustrated with the low level of attention that Myanmar is receiving from the outside world? It doesn't rate. It's very difficult as a journalist to sell the story. I think it's a tragedy. But are you personally frustrated by the attention that Myanmar's not getting?
Well, I'm extremely frustrated by that, Luke. So I join you in that, mate. I think it's a terrible tragedy, made worse by the fact that it should, in some ways, might be a more obvious story for the international community. Because, you know, it's hard to think of a conflict in the world that's as black and white as this one, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are complexities, but gee, it's pretty easy to identify who the guys are wearing the black hats and who are wearing the white hats. I mean, you know,
I totally agree. It's in ASEAN's back door. It's right in their face, and they keep negotiating with the military. One of the reasons why I'm asking this is you touched on a point several times in that referencing the younger generation, and a lot of people tend to dismiss Myanmar, you know, these kind of throwaway prejudices, like, oh, it's always been in conflict, it's always been a civil war, which is not true. But one of the striking changes that I've found is that the difference in attitude between the younger generation and the older generation, it's quite stark.
It really is, Luke. The whole time that I worked with the government, with the civilian government, I had a lot of dealings with the older generation, who were the ministers and all that, but I also had a lot of dealings with the new people coming through. I was the director of research of this thing called the Myanmar Development Institute. Mm-hmm. We had in there about 20 young economists, none of them above 30.
Right.
That was so impressive. And, you know, they've sort of been scattered all over the world now, which is a tragedy. But, of course, they're still around. They can still be brought together. It's also why, mate, I think, you know, a future job for people like myself is in doubt. Because, frankly, they know what to do. They know better than me or people like me. So, I'm just immensely confident, mate, if I just concentrate on that.
Yeah.
Quality and so on of the people who were just coming through, and that's also an extra frustration because, you know, we were really just getting to the stage because it was about the second term, of course, that the NLD government was about to come in place when the coup took place, and that was the moment in which many of the older leaders were sort of moving aside, particularly in the economic areas, and, you know, I think such good things could have been happening around now, you know, were it not for the coup.
Right. I remember many years ago having an argument with a government minder who was assigned to look after me in Rangoon, Yangon. He was banging on about Aung San Suu Kyi bad, military good. And the argument kind of reached this point where I had to basically point out that militaries defend countries. They break things and they kill people. That's what they do. But they don't run economies, they don't do education, they don't do town planning, they don't take care of any of the issues that are required for a civil society to function.
Yeah.
And yet here we are again, back in there, and they still seem to think they can do it.
Absolutely. You highlight something incredibly important, I think, mate, which is a view within, deep within the Burmese military, that they alone are the institution that can hold the country together, that they alone are the institution of competence, which is just extraordinary because, as you say, it's one thing to run a military, which at its heart, exactly as you identify, mate, which is about killing people,
right,
as opposed to the subtle art, the very subtle art of holding a country together, of incentivizing people, running an economy, etc. The skill set is just completely different. But I think that command and control mentality that is so deep in the military just gives them an assumption that they can, that they know better and they can run the place better. When, you know, you look at the evidence, 60 years of military rule, and there's Myanmar, the poorest country in Southeast Asia. So, you know, look to the scoreboard, as we say. And, the verdict on the military is pretty clear.
And it, as you were saying, it goes back 60 years. And a lot of this stems out of World War II, which we don't need to go there. And Aung San Suu Kyi's father, again, we don't need to go there. But it's sort of that self-belief that the military should rule, which was also imposed outside the state of Burma and on the rest of the country. And I think many observers would argue that's what enabled them to stay in power, is this sort of like propaganda campaign that they alone know what's right. And what I find interesting about going back to the younger generation, and 30% of the PDF, the People's Defence Force, are women. And many of them have told me that that belief in the military and that Burma has a kind of a superior role in holding Myanmar together, that's all gone.
No, I completely agree. I think the experiences that may have been there for older generations is just completely different to a younger generation who are much more exposed to the rest of the world. They, you know, celebrate some of the good myths about Myanmar, as people in all countries do, but they're aware of what is a myth and what's reality. And so, yeah, that whole old belief system, I think, is completely crumbled, which, even apart from the brutality of the military, is one of the reasons that, you know, people just don't find it acceptable now that the military should run the country.
Right. Where do you think Myanmar will be 5 years from now?
I'm hopeful it's in a good place, Luke, because I really do think maybe it's the last place for military. It's not just the stuff you look at on the battlefield. With my economist hat on, I spent a lot of time looking at the finances, the flow of money, and of course there's that famous old line which has so much truth, follow the money.
Yeah.
And we can see that money is just deserting the country. We can see it in the actions of the regime, the way that they try and grab every bit of foreign exchange they can get, you know, whether it be worker remittances, the export earnings of exporters, anything, you know, it's really the only economic policy the SAC regime have got at the moment is really about trying to control foreign exchange, to get foreign exchange. They're desperate for it. They need it to buy the advanced weaponry. That is the one advantage they have over the opposition. So, I think, mate, you look at all the indicators, they're all going in the one direction, which is the defeat of this regime. But, you know, again, I'm not naive in thinking that you know, possibly go on and on in a, you know, awful, destructive way, or that, you know, terrible atrocities are not likely, you know, before they come to an end. But I do think their days are numbered. And from that point on, I remain, you know, immensely confident for all the reasons that I mentioned, that, you know, some of the fundamentals, it seems to me, that of who can take over, the ideas, etc., just the different mindset that we've been talking about the whole time. I'm quite confident. It'll be tough, but and in fact, the bounce back could also be quite strong. Again, just speaking as an economist, sometimes what you find when countries really go down, but they go down for man-made reasons, not for anything structural or fundamental to do with the country, but just the political direction. When you turn things around, they can rebound remarkably quickly.
Yep.
And of course, you know, Japan and Germany after World War II will be the classic example. So I think, you know, with good policy, good people, good institutions, all of which is on offer, you know, I'm quite confident that the bounce back could really make the world sit up. You know, we're not there yet. But that's the sort of thing that I think is ahead.
Right. On that note, Sean Tunnell, we'll end it there simply because it's nice to end on a happier note, an optimistic outlook for Myanmar. It doesn't happen very often.
Indeed, mate. If I could just say one thing, it's been really good to speak to someone who has also had the experience of being charged with being a spy. So, Luke, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Okay. I'm going to leave that one alone. Sean Tunnell, thank you very much.
Thanks, Luke.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate. Bye.